I met Susan for lunch at a pub near Coventry. She was with her husband, Lyndon, and a pair of perfectly behaved miniature schnauzers. Susan's in her 70s now, a slight woman with sparkling eyes and brilliant red hair. She was quiet to begin with, understandably cautious about meeting a stranger to talk about traumatic events that happened nearly 60 years ago. Traumatic for Susan more than most, because she's not just a writer with an interest in pirate radio. She's Reg Calvert's daughter. In the early 60s, the Calverts had set up home at the sprawling Clifton Hall near Rugby. And from here, Reg and his wife Dorothy ran a series of popular dance nights, helped by teenage daughters Susan and her sister Candy. Reg was always on the lookout for the next big thing, sort of Simon Cowell meets the Darling Buds of May, I suppose. Clifton Hall was soon teeming with young men looking for their shot at the big time.
When we first moved in, I was nearly 13, I suppose, and the boys, I knew all the boys from my dad employing them. We were just like one big happy family, and to start off with, my mum and I used to cook their meals for them, but then she got sort of tired of cooking all the time, and there was music virtually day and night, all day, except they didn't get up till lunchtime. And to start off with, I couldn't get to sleep at night because it was so loud, but then I got used to it and then you don't hear it anymore. We had a lot of fun, really a lot of fun, and my dad enjoyed having fun.
Most of all though, Reg was a dreamer. I guess in some ways that's the only thing he had in common with Oliver Smedley. In the kitchen at Clifton Hall, he'd plot out his latest harebrained scheme while his long-suffering wife Dorothy, very much the pragmatist, tried to keep him in check.
My dad was always got his head, was you could always tell when he'd got new ideas coming in, because he'd sit usually in the kitchen with a teaspoon in his hand and the sugar bowl and be stirring it round and round, and he wouldn't be with you, he'd be sort of like vacant in his mind, and you knew he was thinking of something but he wouldn't tell you what he was thinking of, he would just be thinking about it. And he's always said to me, if you can dream it, you can do it. So he obviously worked things out in his mind, and then he would talk to my mum about it, and then a lot of ideas she would throw out, she would actually say, I don't want to do that, no, that's not a good idea. And sometimes he would override her and do things that she positively didn't agree with.
If you can dream it, you can do it. That was very much the Reg Calvert philosophy. And talking to Susan, you get a feel for what he was like, restless, almost childlike, but always a steely focus on the latest venture. Shivering Sands was very much a case in point. Initially, Dorothy was dead against it, but Reg was all in on Radio City. He even recruited a teenage Susan to go out to the forts with him and try her hand at being a DJ.
Quite soon, my father found a fisherman who had a boat, a regular fishing boat, who was very safe and very secure. And he wouldn't go out if the weather was too rough. He was very reliable, basically. Fred Downs, he was a really good man. So he hired him to take his crew out there, so it was done safely to Shivering Sands. And when I went out, you had to leap from the boat, and Fred Downs would say, right, go now.
Because his boat's being hit by the waves.
Yeah.
And you've got to jump onto a ladder.
Jump onto a rusty old ladder, And then you had to climb up and up and up and up and up and up until you got to the top. I was 16, I just loved it,
But your mother was not quite so keen.
No, not at all, she didn't like it at all. She didn't like boats, she didn't like water, she didn't like any of that.
Yeah.
And she didn't like radio stations very much.
Dorothy probably had a point. Pirate radio wasn't a business with a secure future. The authorities were constantly trying to find ways to put them out of business. There was a feeling that there was a finite amount of time to make hay before you got shut down for good. This created an atmosphere of rivalries and uneasy alliances, of mistrust and betrayal. By 1965, Oliver Smedley's own foray into pirate radio was faltering. For some time he'd been allied with Radio Caroline, but that was struggling too. The way he saw it, Reg's Radio City might offer a solution. Radio City had the momentum. It had solid infrastructure and regular advertising revenue. Critically, it had Shivering Sands, the jewel in its crown.
Radio City was the only financially profitable individually owned pirate radio station. It was the only one making money. Radio London was doing, I think, okay, very well, and they were very professional. They'd come over from America, they got their advertising in advance, they knew the big advertising companies. Philip Birch, who ran it, he was very, very professional. They knew what they were doing. Radio Caroline didn't know what they were doing. Anyway, my dad didn't know that. He was completely ignorant of the fact that they were going out of business.
Smedley and his associates pressed Reg for a partnership, and for a while, even though no contract was ever signed, Caroline and City worked together. Smedley sourced a new transmitter from the US with a view to increasing the reach of City's audience. The transmitter was a dud, but to Smedley that didn't matter. Reg Calvert and Radio City were now beholden to him. In his mind, he was the brains of the alliance, with the City contacts and the accountancy nous. Reg and Radio City, they were tin pot operators who needed a steady hand to guide them. Oliver Smedley was evidently a slippery customer. Bills went unpaid, promises were broken. Reg, increasingly frustrated, started to look around for other partners. He viewed Radio London as a much more solid bet and began to court Philip Birch. Smedley was furious and vowed to get even. But even by his own unpredictable standards, what he did next was extraordinary.
A team of Essex detectives has gone out to Radio City, based in a disused army fort off the Kent coast, following a complaint that a boarding party had taken it over on Monday.
Oliver Smedley and his associates had recruited a team of heavies, off-duty riggers, literally pulled them out of the pubs around the Kent coast and offered them cash to come with them in a boat at the dead of night to board Shivering Sands and force Radio City off the airwaves. One can only marvel at the spectacle, a James Bond-style undercover op headed by the retired army major and his team of burly henchmen. Smedley even had a glamorous female companion, Kitty Black, a famous West End theatrical agent who was a business crony of Smedley's and evidently had a similar thirst for adventure. At 3 a.m, the party found an open trapdoor in one of the towers and gained entry to Shivering Sands. They rounded up the startled DJs and technicians and removed the vital crystals from the transmitters, rendering them useless. Smedley and Kitty Black returned to shore in triumph, leaving the riggers on board to ensure the station remained off the air indefinitely. It ended up being a week-long siege, a bloodless coup with tea and pleasantries rather than violence, but there was little doubt who was in charge.
Was any violence used at all?
No, there was no violence used, but they came very close to it. They wouldn't allow us to go into the studio or to various parts of the building. They just pushed us out. I did see one man with a gun, although they did deny this, naturally. And
what's happened since they arrived? Are you living in harmony now?
Well, we've got to, really. We've tried very hard to be friendly with these people. After all, we're grossly outnumbered. All these men are very big.
That's Paul Elvey, Radio City's chief engineer, interviewed by a BBC journalist during the siege. It's a bizarre image. Floppy-haired DJs and burly riggers, both parties sitting together, chatting to the media, twiddling their thumbs, awaiting instruction from the mainland on what to do next. But there are undercurrents of skullduggery here too. Just a day earlier, Reg had told his team on the fort to be vigilant, fearing his enemies might just try something drastic like this. More than a little suspicious then that the first door the boarding party tried was conveniently left open for them.
He had told his chief engineer, who was Paul Elvey, to lock all the hatches and make sure they were all locked because there was a problem. Paul Elvey left one hatch open. Oliver Smedley knew exactly which tower to go to because there were five different towers, and he went directly in on the tower where the hatch was open, because had it been locked down, he would never have got on. And as soon as he went into Paul Elvey's bedroom, Paul Elvey jumped up and said, "Oh, hello, Mr. Smedley." So one wonders.
Whether the siege at Shivering Sands was an inside job or not, Smedley now held the upper hand. With Radio City off the air and his team held captive in the Thames estuary, Reg Calvert reached breaking point. Major had the crystal that powered the transmitter and was using it as leverage to push Reg into abandoning his plans with Radio London and signing a deal with Radio Caroline instead. Push came to shove at a tense meeting in Soho the day following the boarding. Smedley told Reg that if his team tried anything, the riggers would destroy all of the city equipment and ruin the station permanently. To Smedley, it might have felt like a solid offer, but by any other measure, it was blackmail, pure and simple. In the later testimony of Smedley, Kitty Black and others who were present at that meeting, Reg then became deranged, vowing to end the siege himself. He boasted of his own tough credentials earned on the Northern dance hall scene. He claimed to have connections to fighters and killers. He even professed to be an expert in explosives and nerve gas. And to prove it, he removed what he said was a state-of-the-art weapon, a gas pen, from his jacket pocket and showed it to the astonished onlookers. Those close to Reg have strongly contested this account. Susan says none of it rings true at all. Her father was an extremely peaceable man, definitely a lover, not a fighter. He was not one for showboating or bravado.
Swearing, he never swore in his life. He didn't believe in bad language. You know, red-faced, when he was angry, he went white, he didn't go red. There were so many things that were wrong. My mum knew as soon as she started saying things like that, that my dad hadn't actually lost his temper.
The trouble was, Reg had no allies in that room, and when he left it, the impression he gave was of a dangerous man with a score to settle. Reg and his friend and colleague Alan Arnold drove to Wendon Zambo on Midsummer's night, June the 21st, 1966, to have it out with Smedley. They arrived late in the evening and were met at the door by a young woman named Pamela Thorburn. Officially, she was Oliver Smedley's housekeeper and assistant, but she was also, almost certainly, his lover. And from that moment, two distinct narratives emerge. The first comes largely from Smedley's own testimony and that of Pamela Thorburn. In this version, Reg Calvert is in an uncontrollable rage. He barges past Thorburn into the house. "Where's Smedley?" he snarls. Thorburn starts to ring the police, but Reg pulls the phone out of the wall. He crashes through the small cottage, searching for his prey, threatening Pamela Thorburn all the while. But Smedley has the advantage of being on home turf. Anticipating Reg Calvert's arrival, he's armed himself with a shotgun and crept out to the back of the property. When he finally comes face to face with Calvert, his worst fears are realised. This man is dangerous, unpredictable, and has already roughed up a young, innocent woman. He fires a single shot. It's impulsive and entirely justifiable. The actions of a man defending his home, his castle, his lover, from brutal attack. Later, when detectives start their investigation, they find a strange looking device, the size of a fountain pen, in Reg Calvert's inside pocket. In the second narrative, based on the accounts of eyewitnesses who were never called to trial, and of those who knew Reg Calvert well, the violent tirade simply never happened. Reg was upset, yes. More than that, he was angry. But it simply wasn't in his nature to be violent. He never barged in, never threatened Pamela Thorburn, didn't shout or swear or throw things around. He merely wanted to talk to Smedley. He'd even bought cash with him to pay off the riggers if the words got him nowhere. Crucially, other eyewitnesses, including Alan Arnold, said that Reg seemed calm and rational. Initially, upon arrival at Wendon Zambo, he and Arnold knocked on the door of the wrong house. Note, they knocked. They didn't hammer frantically. And Reg was polite to the homeowner who pointed out his mistake. This was not a crazed man looking to wreak havoc. It was a man who'd come to negotiate. Oliver Smedley, meanwhile, knew exactly what was coming and how he was going to deal with it. He sent his assistant to open the door and lay in wait out of sight.
As soon as he came, he went out through, he loaded his gun, went out the back door, saw the people in the cottage behind, said, phone the police, there's going to be trouble, came through the other door and without warning shot my dad and killed him.